So the other day I was thinking, you know, I've given all of these talks on death and dying, and I was really worried, like, am I doing this too much? Is like, should I lighten it up with something else? And I walked into a restaurant with my wife and saw a couple of people from the Sangha, and they went, "Oh, hey, it's Dr. Death." So this is for you guys, one more. So I'm going to read you something. It's a piece of a speech that was given by Chief Seattle of the Duwamish tribe in regard to the selling of native lands to settlers. It's a speech he gave March 11th, 1854. So I ask, just as you listen to this, to really listen with your body. Don't just listen with the words. Hear what he says and see what he says. The president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. But how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us. Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, all are holy in the memory and experience of my people. We're part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great eagle, these are our brothers. Each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. They carry our canoes and feed our children. If we sell you our land, remember that the air is precious to us, that the air shares its spirit with all the life it supports. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also receives his last sigh. This we know: the earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected like the blood that unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. Your destiny is a mystery to us. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered? What will happen when the secret corners of the forest are heavy with the scent of many men and the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? The end of living and the beginning of survival. When the last red man has vanished with his wilderness and his memory is only the shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, will these shores and forests still be here? Will there be any spirit of my people left? We love this earth as a newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we have loved it. Care for it as we've cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you receive it. Preserve the land for all children and love it as God loves us all. One thing we know: there is only one God. No man, be he red man or white man, can be apart. We are all brothers after all. So I'd like to just ask, what does that bring up for you? What does that make you feel? Any takers?
Deep sadness.
Deep sadness. Anything else?
Something sacred is lost.
Lost sacredness.
Loss of
Interconnectedness, loss of interconnectedness.
I had just waves of chills and goosebumps. Just like kept coming in waves.
Chills and
Just, I think,
goosebumps.
with the recognition of the deep truth of it.
The deep truth of it.
A feeling of betrayal.
Betrayal. The quality of these emotions, are they warm or cold? It's warm, right? So if there was one word that captured all of these qualities, what word would that be?
Sky.
Sky.
Love.
Love.
Appreciation.
Appreciation.
Care.
care.
Belonging.
I'm sorry?
Belonging.
Mystery.
So the word I came up with is grief. If you read the psychological literature about grief, you're all right. It's just my Dharma talk, so we'll be sticking with grief. So if you read the literature about grief, you'll notice that it typically it's defined as being a temporary response to loss. Someone we care about dies, a relationship ends, we lose our job, and suddenly we enter a period of time characterized by a kind of depression or depressive-like symptoms. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross quantified grief as a process in which one passes through five recognizable stages. First, there's denial, then anger, bargaining, depression, and then lastly, acceptance. The assumption underlying this five-stage model, as well as much of the psychological literature, is that grief is a time-bound process in which one is expected to eventually reach the other side and return to her normal life activities, pretty much as if the death or the loss never happened. My question is, what if this entire model is wrong? What if grief asks far more of us than that we simply feel it for a time and then put it away? What if we aren't actually meant to get over grief? What if grief isn't actually about feeling at all, but is rather something more active, something we must do? What if grief is in fact a skill that, once learned, fundamentally changes who we are, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to others, how we behave in society, and how we relate to the environment? What if successfully learning how to grieve is in fact a stage of psychological development or a rite of passage, the successful navigation of which is necessary to our becoming fully mature adult human beings? And if this is true, what might the consequences be that we might expect if we fail to achieve to learn how to grieve? This is some of what I want to explore tonight. Chief Seattle's speech, it's a beautiful and a tragic articulation of the difference in worldview between the indigenous Duwamish people and the European settlers. To the settlers, the land is viewed as a commodity. It is an inanimate object, a thing to be bought or sold, and whose only meaning or value lies in what resources can be extracted from it or what can be built upon it. To the Duwamish, on the other hand, there is no separation between the earth as body and human beings as bodies. We're part of the earth, says Chief Seattle, and it is part of us. The perfume flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great eagle, these are our brothers. It's important to realize that Chief Seattle isn't speaking metaphorically here. He's speaking literally. To him and his people, the plants and animals are family. The European settlers have no such connection to the land they intend to purchase. The Duwamish, by contrast, have a family history that runs generation deep throughout the surrounding mountains, rivers, and streams. As Chief Seattle says, every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, all are holy in the memory and experience of my people. To the Duwamish, the land is their storyteller and the keeper of their history. Each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The land is also keeper of the dead. The water's murmur is the voice. This was easier to read at home. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also receives his last sigh. To the Duwamish, the dead are not gone from the world, but rather coexist among the living. This isn't true for the Europeans. Their dead are buried on another continent. their spirits gone from the world up to heaven. Similarly, among the Duwamish, past events and memories aren't relegated to the ether of the mind, but have real purchase in the physical world, their presence everywhere in evidence throughout the landscape. If you're like me, when you heard this speech of Chief Seattle's, your heart and mind were stirred, and the world was suddenly made alive in a way that maybe it wasn't before. Previously, you likely held that the natural world was beautiful, but did you ever imagine yourself and all of your ancestors to be so deeply and inextricably a part of it all? Again, if you're like me, the answer is likely no. And yet all it takes is for Chief Seattle to speak, and suddenly the trees hang heavy with the stories of your ancestral dead, their voices murmuring to you in the brook. And the same wind that gave them breath and then later took it back gives us our breath now. So why is it that we don't live this way that Chief Seattle describes? Why is it that so few of us are even aware of the possibility of such interconnection? The short answer is because the story Chief Seattle tells of the indigenous Duwamish is not our own. Our story, like it or not, is that of the European settlers. They are our ancestors, and it is their story and their way of being in the world that we have inherited. Now, some might balk at that statement and insist that everyone is free to live by whatever narrative that he or she so chooses. Well, I respectfully disagree. The Duwamish did not see themselves living a story any more than we see ourselves living one. And yet, as we have seen, our respective experiences of reality itself are vastly different from each other. So this would suggest that we are actually each living a story, but that these stories are so deeply embedded in the fabric of who we are that we can't even see that we're in them. Therefore, whatever change one might achieve by adopting someone else's narrative, someone else's way of being in the world, can only be ever be superficial at best. If we truly want to change who and how we are in the world, we have to look deeply into who and how we have been historically. This is as true for the individual as it is for the society. For example, over the last couple of years, the use of body cameras brought to public attention their irrefutable truth that Black American men were routinely being murdered at the hands of police. This news wasn't news to the Black community. They had been suffering this injustice and speaking out about it for decades. The revelation of these ongoing murders was only news to the white dominant majority. Most had no knowledge until confronted by the evidence of the camera footage of just how widespread and common an occurrence these murders actually were. So how had this been able to happen? How had the cries of the Black community never been heard until now? And how had white America been able for so long to not know what was being done in the name of providing them protection? In brief, what had made its way into the mainstream over this period was that white people, no matter how liberal or anti-racist, were nonetheless participants and beneficiaries of an inherently racist social system. A system so pervasive and so deeply woven into the fabric of their own identity that most were unable to even see it. As a result of this revelation, the white majority was suddenly confronted with the fact that they were the direct living heirs and beneficiaries of the abomination that had been the North American slave trade, and that much of that system was still very much in place and in operation. It was just better hidden. White people reacted to this indictment in more or less one of two ways. Some doubled down on their willful blindness and claimed the whole idea of white privilege to be a fiction. Others, meanwhile, took hold of the difficult truth as best they could and set out on the long, lonely, difficult road of healing and transformation. Slavery is one of the legacies handed down to us by our ancestors. And none of us can escape its influence on our lives by simply walking away and adopting someone else's story. If we are to change our story, we have to work with our story. We can't run from it. To end the legacy of white privilege and institutionalized racism, we of the white majority must transform ourselves individually and collectively, as well as how we relate to our Black countrymen. Those who can do that, those who can turn towards, take in, and tolerate being with the generations of stolen Black lives upon whose bones and blood this country was built and molded to our benefit, are those with a capacity to grieve. Grief as a developmental stage or rite of passage initiates the individual into a way of being in the world whereby the delusion of mind that gives rise to duality and the conviction of separateness between self and other, between humankind and the natural world, between past and present, between the dead and the living, is irrevocably overthrown. Meanwhile, those who lack the capacity to grieve, who in their defense against overwhelming sorrow insist white privilege is a fiction and the problem of racism has long been solved, are doomed to live out their days untethered to the earth, untethered to meaning, and forsaken by their ancestral dead. Learning the skill of grief is the pathway and the cost of open-hearted healing and present-centered living. Insight meditation invites us to see the impermanent nature of our every thought, belief, and perception. It is a process of forever letting go, a process of dying to the contrived and being born anew over and over into love, healing, and interconnection. It is a process of grief. So I'd like to close here with a piece by Thich Nhat Hanh. He says in two paragraphs, what it took me 20 minutes to say. This morning, before giving a Dharma talk, I was having breakfast with my attendant, a lovely novice monk. Have you ever heard his voice? If ever Jesus spoke, right? Or the Buddha. This morning, before giving a Dharma talk, I was having breakfast with my attendant, a lovely novice monk. I paused and said to him, "Dear one, do you see the cow on the hillside? She is eating grass in order to make my yogurt, and I am now eating the yogurt to make a Dharma talk. Somehow, the cow will offer today's Dharma talk." As I drink the cow's milk, I was a child of the cow. The Buddha recommends we live our daily life in this way, seeing everything in the light of interbeing. Then we will not be caught in our small self. We will see our joy and our suffering everywhere. We will be free. The deeper level of practice is to lead our daily life in a way that we touch both the absolute and the relative truth. In the dimension of relative truth, the Buddha passed away many years ago. But in the realm of absolute truth, we can take his hand and join him for walking meditation every day. When you hear the sound of the bell, listen with your ears, and also listen with the ears of your ancestors, your children, and their children. Listen in the relative and absolute dimensions at the same time. You don't have to die to enter nirvana or the kingdom of God. You only have to dwell deeply in the present moment, right now.